Adam Duritz is a dear friend for many years, and he's my guest today on Bob Saget's Here For You, the 100th episode, the 100th, 100 episodes. I started wanting to do this podcast long before the pandemic, and in 2019, at the end of the year, I was going to start it as soon as we got into 2020, and then it's been a year of shows throughout this crazy time, and a couple shows in studio quickly turned into Zoom, turned into what the show became, and I just thank all of you. Thank you all for your kind words. I've had such amazing guests this whole 100 shows, this whole year. It's really been something that I love. I don't think I'll ever stop doing the damn thing unless I can't talk or function, which I don't think will happen because I'm a highly functioning person. It depends what I ate that day. I am in New York City. I came here to see two of my kids and to do some stand-up because I'm on tour, everybody. I'm on tour. Just go to bobsaget.com. I'll be on tour all year. And I think Adam and the Crows are going out big time. So we're going to find out about that. He's in London. And so he is going to be coming to me in just moments. And I'm incredibly excited about it because I love him. I love this guy. We met years ago, right after August and Everything After came out with Round Here Exploded on MTV. And he's on the train tracks. So I want to go back in time a little. And they have a brand new album out, which is so interesting. It's just the first half of it. It's called Butter Miracle Suite One. And it's really like four amazing songs that are all tied together in kind of a rock opera kind of way. But I'll let him do that because he'll tell me that I'm wrong because he's incredibly smart and incredibly sweet and talented. And okay, so Bob Saget's here for you. You want to do what? You want to subscribe and you want to listen, or you can follow depending. You can go to the YouTube page, which is youtube.com/Bob Saget. You can watch exciting Zoom broadcasts. It's so funny when people say, I loved watching your episode today. And I'm like, really? You watched that? You watched a 90-minute, two-hour-long split screen? It's almost like a South Park episode, the quality of the video. But that's kind of what we've become. Anyway, do what you can do. Rate, review, subscribe. They tell you to say those buzzwords with the podcast. It's the 100th episode, everybody. Thank you for getting me here. And I'll just keep doing it because I really love it and having conversations with people that I find interesting and care about and learn from. So here comes Adam Duritz from Counting Crows. Oh, you're outdoors. You're a frontiersman.
I'm a man of the woods, Bob. Man of the woods.
You are. You got all that land in London. You buy a ranch in London?
No, I'm not in London. I'm a few hours west of there.
Got it.
In the West. What do we call the West?
So what is it? Where are you?
My friend's farm.
That's nice. Are there cows?
They're not on his property, right next door. There's some cows. They have sheep here. A lot of horses. Are there horses there right now? That they're in that pasture, three of them. There's about 10 horses here. He trains horses for the Olympics. One of them is almost certainly going, possibly a second.
And what do? Do they ride that horse every day? Do they take it out on a track? Do they have to transport it to the place?
It's a venting. So they have a lot of it here. They have like, you know, they do some posing. They have a steeplechase kind of thing. And they have a cross country kind of thing. And then they have jumps that they do that. You see the people in the top hats that horse jump. That's what they do.
I'd fall off and die. Have you been riding?
Oh, no, I haven't. I think Zoe went for a ride. I've done some fishing, shot some guns.
That you've been shooting fish?
Shot some fish. I suggested that because I was having no luck catching them on a fishing line.
No,
I thought it might be easy to shoot them.
You got to put them in a barrel. That's the expression. So
that is the fish are good in a barrel, pheasant in a barrel, sheep in a barrel. The thing is, the barrel is like a universal way to like it just all works in a barrel. It's hard to miss, really.
There's a website for sheep in a barrel. That's a whole different thing. So I'm really happy to talk to you. First thing, this is my 100th episode. You're my 100th. Well, you're my 98th person. I think I was doing it. Well, I did episodes where I would call people and then I would have friends on, and you and I have been, it actually says on my calendar to get the link, Bob's friend, Adam Durrett. So I could send it to you. So it, you're as a friend, it says. That's how you're labeled.
I saw that. I saw that it said to my friend, Adam Durrett. That's nice.
So now you, what brought you to go to the UK right now? Cause you've got the new album that literally just came out. You're done. It's half the album, right?
Well, no, it's the whole record. I just may make it twice as big. I mean, it was only supposed to be this one suite, but then I really like it. So I think I'm going to do a second one. This is where I wrote it, though.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, I don't think people know what a suite is.
I came over here, I guess. I mean, I've been coming here a lot the last 5 years or so. This farm, I just really love it. Mm-hmm. And I came here in August of 2019, I guess. We landed in London and went to my friend's house there. He was at work and Zoe crashed because she was jet lagged. And I went and washed my face and I was trying to think of taking a shower. I was just trying to wake up and I looked on the counter and saw these hair clippers and I shaved off my dreads.
Right.
And that's how that happened. And then I came out to the farm a couple days later and spent the next couple months here. And I, after a little while, I was really feeling like playing piano. So rented a keyboard and a friend drove it down. And then I started playing. And a couple days later, I wrote the song, Tall Grass.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day I kind of came back and I was playing it again. I wasn't sure if I was finished with it. It seemed done, but I had been thinking maybe I wanted to make it a little longer. And I was trying out different stuff at the end. And I sang this line, Bobby was a kid from around the town. And I really liked how that worked on the end of the Tall Grass.
Right.
But I thought it was a different song. And then I got this idea. Well, what if I wrote a series of songs where the end of one is the beginning of another and they just flow.
Right.
Songs can be totally different, but they flow seamlessly together. And that, I got this idea to write a suite.
I literally had no idea that Elevator Boots was starting. And then it's a completely different thing, but yet the theme, and then it goes into Angel of 14th Street and Bobby and the Rat Kings. But then you've got, you repeat them four times and they're different lengths. What is the single edit mean of those four songs that are all part of the suite?
Well, when we were almost done recording, one of us, I don't remember whose idea it was, thought maybe we should go back and record some endings for these songs. Cause there's no endings on them. You know, they just go straight into the next song.
Right.
There's a case one of them is going to be a single or something. Maybe there should be a version where it actually stops. So we went back and did that, but they were only supposed to be for it. Like if something's a single on the radio, you can play the version that stops, or if you want to put it on a playlist, I guess you can do that too, but they're meant to be listened to all in a row. And we just included those single edits as like bonus tracks. But then the record company, there was some confusion, I guess, because the day it came out, they released it as the four single edits. So I've been talking for a month to everyone about how, in all the press, about how it's these four songs that flow together like one long song. And when they released them, they did not. They just stopped. So I had a fucking heart attack.
But you gave it to them. So that's what happens is they use the separate parts because they want to sell every part of the cow. No pun intended for your location. So, Adam, we've been friends a long time. I didn't even realize. I mean, it's literally probably the year August and everything after came out or a year later that we met.
It might have been a little before that because I knew Laurie because my goddaughter's godmother was Laurie. And I remember meeting you. I don't remember if it was before or after the record came out.
I think it was before. And then we didn't really connect until I saw you at the Viper Room one night. And I didn't understand why you were behind the bar because you had, you were all over MTV singing Round Here, which is the song in that album that took my heart and, you know, billions of people's hearts because it just resonated forever to this moment. It's a point in my life. So there you were behind the bar. Thanks. So how did that happen?
Well, the only people I really knew well in LA that I'd met while I was touring were the people that worked at the Viper Room. And you know, it came about kind of weirdly because I'd been hanging out there in some of my off time, and but I was on the road for a year and a half on that first record. And when I got home finally after a year and a half, there were people camped out on my lawn, and it was really weird. I couldn't go anywhere in Berkeley, and I was having a hard time the first week. I'd only been home for about a week, and it had kind of been a nightmare. And I got a phone call one day, and it was Sal Janko and Johnny Depp calling from the Viper Room. And they started to invite me to this party. And then I guess it was clear to them that something was wrong. And they asked me, and I told them what was going on. And there was some mumbling in the background, and they said, just hang on. And they put me on hold. And I sat there for like 5 minutes wondering what the fuck they were doing. And then they came back and they said, look, we were calling you to invite you. It's Kate Moss's 21st birthday tonight, and we're having a party at the Viper Room. And we wanted to invite you, but more importantly, we've got you a reservation on the 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock flight, Oakland to Burbank. Someone will pick you up at the airport, and we got you a room at the Bellage. And so you need to get the fuck out of there right now, because you're obviously unhappy and it's not cool. And just come down here. We're having a party and we want you here. And I was like, they just did everything for me. I mean, there was like one of the bar backs or the bartenders was at the airport when I got there. And I never really went back. I sort of stayed at the Bellage for a couple of days. I got a bungalow at the Sunset Marquee after that.
Right.
I used to see you there a lot.
Yeah,
too.
We hung out there.
And then one day the bartender, Shannon McManus from the Viper Room, said, hey, have you considered like renting a house down here? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, my best friend just bought a house, and she had this little cottage in Laurel Canyon, and she just wants to rent it to someone that she likes. Would you mind going up and meeting her? And I said, sure. And so Shannon picked me up from the hotel, and we drove up to, well, what turned out to be Christina Applegate's house. And she was her best friend, and Christina rented me her cottage in Laurel Canyon. And I lived there for a couple of years before I bought a place of my own. But at that point, like, all of the people I knew best in LA worked at the Viper Room, except for a few people like you. And I hadn't seen you in a while, I guess, at that point, because I'd been on tour.
Right.
So I used to just hang out at the Viper, and there was more room on the other side of the bar. So I just started hanging out. And one time Shannon had to go to the bathroom, asked me if I would cover the bar, and I realized I knew how to do it. So I did it. And the next thing I know, I was bartending at the Viper Room every night.
I wandered into the Viper Room, and it was 1993. And this is September 93 is when August came out. It's a shame you couldn't release it in August, because it would have been perfect. But, you know,
it is about everything after.
That's what I met you. So right when it came out, I met you with Lori, right? Lori Loughlin. And then right after that, I wandered into the Viper Room because I was losing my sister Gage to the disease scleroderma, which you have been so crazy generous. I'll explain in a second for the listener people. And I was in there with my nephew, Adam, and you met Adam with me that night. I think it was the first night. And then we saw each other after that at Lori's. I think that's what happened. I'm not sure the order, but around here, I played on a loop, and the lyric, you know, Maria says she's dying. I don't know. And my sister was in Cedars and she was dying. And that's a hospital for people that don't live specifically at Beverly and Robertson. And you were so, we just met. Really, or we talked maybe whatever the order is, but you were so genuine and compassionate that I couldn't believe that you had such sensitivity and empathy for my nephew and I, as much for my nephew as for me. And it meant so much to him. It's his mother. And we lost her a year later. And it was a horrible time, obviously. But that we had just had a connection at that time. And I couldn't stop playing that album. And it really got me through. But then knowing you became bigger than all of it, and we just became friends. It was at a very, those poignant really moments in your life are when you sometimes find out who your new friends are and where you are with relationships with people.
Yeah. I think it's funny that I can't remember where the first time was, but like, it's been such a long time. Also, we're getting old and senile.
I'm not senile because I'm wearing pants and I know where I am. Although I did a morning radio this morning because I'm doing stand up everywhere that I go because I have to do it. I have to tour. I'm able to do it now. So like, I'm dying for it. And I was on the wrong floor. So I went, oh no. And I hadn't had enough sleep. And I actually texted my wife, Kelly, and said, what floor? I was like, have you seen my pants? Where are my keys? Fuck. Aren't you the nurse? You went out of your mind because it was your first real fame. And that's when they kind of saved you and said, get the hell out of there. Cause there's people everywhere. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was doing okay, I guess. I had had a little bit of a breakdown earlier in that year, 94, but by the time I got home, it was, I guess this is like the first week of January of 95. And that's when I moved to LA, something like that. I don't remember. I'd have to look when Kate Moss's birthday is, but it's something like that, right at the beginning of January.
All roads lead to Kate Moss's birthday.
Well, I guess then if you were at the Viper Room, then they did because she was Johnny's girl. But I will tell you one thing I remember about that party was that, I mean, holy shit. At that point in history, that's when they really had supermodels. I mean, really, there was like 8 of them that were so iconic at that moment. Mm-hmm. And they were all there. You know, I'm like, I may have been a rock star at that point, but I've been in hotel rooms and buses for a year and a half. I hadn't experienced really being a rock star at all.
Right.
You know, I had no idea of what that was. I came down to LA, my first night in LA, I'm at this party. You know, I think it's the night I became friends with Josh Richmond too, because he was there. And I was just so overwhelmed by the 6 feet, or as Josh calls them, tall chicks everywhere, tall chicks. You know, they were
that's
just
lovely phrase. That's definitely stuck into 2021.
Oh my God. It was overwhelming. And it was fun though. You know, and I really liked LA right then too. You know, I met a lot of people who were also, I came from a struggling artist town, and I think it was hard for a lot of people there to deal with us having that sudden success. But in LA, everybody was just doing their own thing and their own work, and they just kind of wanted to see what we were doing and tell me what they were doing. And it was kind of a working artist town that way. And mm-hmm. I felt very comfortable when I got there.
We've had some crazy fun times. We've done some silly fun things. I was about to ask you about your previous band, but I can't help but go, holy shit, have we had some good times?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, as much as a horrific tragedy as scleroderma has been in your life, I have so many great, warm, fond memories of the scleroderma benefits with you, of going there, of playing sometimes myself, or of just hanging out with you and whatever other comedians, Michael, Jeff, of course, Gilbert, Gottfried, Michael Shea, so many people that have been so great and shown up at those things. I mean, they come out for you. You know, people love you and they come out for it. The twins are always there. You know, Ashley, Mary Kate sometimes. It's just a great group of people that come out to help out with the foundation, but largely because they love you, you know, and I have so many funny, great memories from those benefits, you know.
Well, you've done a first thing. Thank you. You know, you lose somebody to a disease, and then if you're in a position, you can try to help. And thanks to you, I mean, you've done you've performed at the benefit twice with the Crows and once solo, unexpectedly at the last minute. But there was one time you did it in L.A. at the Beverly Wilshire, and it was just amazing. And then one time in San Francisco, you guys came in. And then in New York, you at the last minute came in with the keyboard and you went, oh, I don't really play well. I'm like, that right. And then it's like masterful. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Somebody couldn't come that night. That's right.
It was Jackson Browne. Jackson Browne. And then he came a couple years later. He did it for us. And that's the beauty of that's the only gift, I think, of celebrity is that, and I hate the word normally because it doesn't mean that you're an author or an actor or whatever. You're just I'm famous, you know, or people want to take their picture, but it's if you can bring people and I guess it's people's hearts, and you've got a hell of a big one. So we've raised over $50 million to help people with the Scleroderma Research Foundation. And yeah, you've come to them and sat there. And I think you saw Robin Williams do it. He did it 7 times. Did you see Robin when Gilbert was there and Jimmy Fallon one night?
I'm not sure if I was there. I saw Robin a couple times when I was young in clubs, because I used to be obsessed with comedy, and San Francisco was such a big comedy place.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw Robin a couple times. One, I remember it was like a night where they were doing like established comics and young comics, and they would follow each other. And he was paired up with Jake Johansson.
Who I love. Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
They were both, and he was so amazing. He clearly did the entire thing off the top of his head.
Right.
Very rarely have I seen something so furious, fast, and clearly being invented on the spot. It was crazy.
Yeah. I want to go back in time and talk to you, but I still want to keep talking about other stuff because I haven't talked to you. So I'm going to just talk to you until I have to go and talk to you about history of you, because I found out you end up researching your friend, which is like, it's like, okay, I know all the music, but I know, but I didn't know that. But I mean, I just remember us, and we were meeting, it was Ashley Olson and my daughter Aubrey and a few other friends, and you and I were we took the subway, and I wasn't a subway guy. I didn't understand them. And it was raining, and it says we're getting off at Sullivan Street, and we get off. And I said, I got to ask you, it was just you and me with umbrellas. I'm like learning how to work an umbrella for the first time. And I said, okay, so is this Sullivan Street? And do you remember your answer? I'm sure it's your pat answer for it.
No, what did I say? I mean, you said, no, but.
But okay, and it seemed there's no way it could not be this Sullivan Street, because that's what we were going to. We were going to El Molino for dinner, and you said, no, it's just Sullivan Street was a perfect name to use for that street in the song.
Yeah, you know, because I lived in Berkeley then, and I don't think I had really, I'd been to New York, but I don't think I was familiar with the village at all. I'd come to New York as a kid. But no, it's weird. That name just came to me. I don't know if I'm trying to remember. It's about this girlfriend I had who lived on the far side of San Francisco. And right after we started dating, her very, very Catholic mother came out and stayed with her for a month. And so every time we'd go on a date, she couldn't stay at my house because that would not be okay with her mom. I mean, we were probably 20, you know? And so I had to drive her home. Either if we were in Berkeley, I'd have to, you know, down through the hills from my house, all the way across Berkeley to the bridge, across the bridge to San Francisco. And then she lived on the far side of San Francisco. So you have to drive through surface streets all the way there. So it was about 40 minutes each way. And I'd be doing this in the middle of the night over and over again, crossing the water and going back, you know, and coming back alone, you know, and, I sort of wrote that song about that experience of just constantly driving alone in the middle of the night, having to take the girl I really liked home and instead of just going to sleep with her, you know? But I don't know. I'm trying to remember if there's a Sullivan Street in San Francisco that she lived near, but I don't know. When I just started playing the song, it just kind of came in as the word, but I don't think I knew the village. So it couldn't have been that yet.
It's pretty fortuitous because you knew the village pretty well after that. It became... And then it's funny to know you and you speak in lyrics from your songs. Like just now you were saying, you know, in the middle of the night and the pouring rain, and that's Omaha.
Water, which is the line from the song. Yeah, that's right.
It's so funny that it's so genuine. And that's why your music's always been so great and resonated. I was reading a bunch of articles. You've had a lot of press lately, as you know, because of the suite. And it's so interesting that you've gotten raves for this suite that you've written, and it's the nicest press that I've read for a while. What's that like?
Well, it's the weirdest thing. I mean, you know, this, like, you just never stay everybody's favorite forever. At some point, like, it pisses everybody off. You know, you start off and you're like, we got really lucky in the beginning. We couldn't buy a bad review and everyone loved the first album, so they just loved us. And then, you know, at some point in there, everybody gets tired of you, or they love discovering you for themselves, but you get a little too popular and now they have to share you with that asshole you see at the water cooler who likes all the fucking shitty music. And it's like, I don't want to share this with him. Fuck those guys, you know? You know, so we definitely spent a few years in a decade or more as this uncool thing. And you saw it sort of unraveling a little bit during Somewhere Under Wonderland, the last couple albums, even Saturday Nights and Sunday Mornings a little bit.
I love Saturday Nights and Sunday Mornings because it makes me feel of being right where I am right now in New York, you know, yeah, reading a newspaper outside on a Sunday.
But now it's weird. It's like all good reviews. Everybody seems to be like, they're really invested in how cool we are or something. And, or that we've just lived long enough that, you know, like,
that's what happens.
Die, they love you.
Right. Yeah. It's more than that. But they're like, oh, no, he hasn't lost it. He's more relevant than ever and all this stuff. But and a lot of people have had this happen. It's like, I never went away, you know, and your work ethic, I mean, it's never gone away. You've always been doing everything.
Yeah, I mean, we've just played the whole time. You know, there's not much you can do about it. You got to make music you love. You got to do the thing you love. And you hope people will grasp it or take the time to listen to it. And, you know, I always hoped it would kind of come around the bend the other way and people would get back to, like, digging our band again. But I have to admit, I wasn't really sure. But it does seem to have come around. Like, people seem to be genuinely, you know, thrilled with this record.
Well, they should be, because it's fucking awesome.
Thank
you. Now, is there a second suite coming? You intimated.
Well, that's kind of what I'm doing here. I'm hoping, I mean, I wrote all the rest of it here. And so I'm sort of hoping that I've got my keyboard set up in the other room over there. And as soon as I imagine tomorrow or the next day, I'll just get into playing again. Right now, there's a few people here at the house, so but they're going back to London tomorrow, and Joe's going back up to London tonight for work, so it's just going to be me and Zoe here. So I imagine I will sort of sink into the keyboard a little bit and like to try and write the second suite. I'm going to be over here for a month, so I want to try and do that.
That's exciting, actually, and I hear a bird. Does the bird help you?
The birds help me. Sometimes I shoot them.
gonna shoot sheep and fish and no sheep sheep in a barrel.
I shot a pheasant the other day. We just got in here on the first day and there was a pheasant.
You shot a pheasant. Do you feel bad about it? It's a nice bird, right?
It was delicious.
So you ate the damn thing?
Yeah. I mean, they're for food.
You know, right. Did
tonight,
you?
I found in the big meat freezer some venison from like last year that I think Zoe shot, and we made bolognese from that.
You are a good cook.
I cooked when I was a kid, but during pandemic, I really started cooking.
And you put a lot of it online, and a lot of good Instagram meals with you. Isn't that weird how there's so much damaging stuff on all these platforms, but I got to see you. I got to be in your place. I got to look at all the dishes that are in the sink and all those pots that are full of pasta sauce. When did you always love cooking this much?
Well, it was something. So me and my friend Joey used to do. We got really into getting wasted and cooking when we were younger. So we were like, we really go kind of highbrow with it. We were, you know, it's like the early, it's like 1982, maybe 84. I just remember, like, you know, we grew up interested in cooking, but then we decided we wanted, like, sushi is not everywhere at that point. There are very few sushi restaurants. I don't even know if there was one, but we read about sushi. And so we got like a book on sushi. We went down to Chinatown in Oakland and we found this. It was just like a nondescript door on the street. But if you went down into it, there was this room underground full of fish tanks. And they had just like tunas in there and like yellowtails and octopus. And so we bought some fish, really fresh fish. Then we went to the video store and rented Kurosawa's movie Kagamusha, because we had read about that too.
Yeah.
And we got high as fuck, and we made sushi for a couple hours, just high as kites, and then we sat down with the sushi and we watched Kagamusha.
That's kind of heavenly.
Yeah, so we started doing that. Like, instead of just throwing a party, we would like come down from college. My parents would be out of town because my mom was off at medical school, and we would just sort of commandeer the house, and we would cook like 4 or 5 course dinners, make duck and all kinds of shit, and get wasted. And we would like have, instead of having like a huge party, we would just invite like 10 friends over, and we would make these massive dinners while we were wasted. And so we got really into cooking back then, and I've always done it. But like, you know, I woke up a couple months into the pandemic, and I just thought, I went to Zoe and I said, man, I'm really worried I'm going to wake up a year from now and I won't have done anything, because this is going to go on for a while.
Right.
I said, I think I'm going to try to learn to cook everything. Like, I'm going to cook a Chinese meal for you, and I'm learning to cook Thai food, and I'm going to like work on all these different recipes. And I wasn't planning on putting anything online. I started all the effort that I was putting into research for the podcast, because we couldn't do it, I put into researching like food and recipes. After a while, I started throwing some of it up on Instagram stories. And then Zoe said, you know, you should get an app for editing, and you should learn to edit this stuff and put them on Instagram TV. They'd be really cool. And so I learned how to do that, and she helped a lot. And yeah, I started putting them up. But the weird thing was that they caught on.
Yeah.
I started getting these offers from people. My manager gets calls about people who want to do cooking shows. And Charlie's wife, Nikki, works for American Idol. She's one of the producers on American Idol now. And she's like, everyone here is obsessed with your cooking things.
I am.
I want to know if you want to do a cooking show. I would way rather do a cooking show with you. Like, I don't know about it. I love cooking. I don't love TV shows. I'm not sure I want to be on one. That could ruin cooking for me.
Now, if you were here a couple blocks away, you'd be cooking. I'd be probably coming over your place. You'd be making some kind of, I remember having bolognese a lot. You're very good at that.
At what?
Ragu. Bolognese.
You mean like
bolognese? I'm the Jew that says bolognese.
How about, is he saying bologna or bologna?
Oh, I remember coming over to your house and I would blow you. That's what I meant.
That's what it is. That's
I got confused.
Well, it's enormous, you know. So,
but you were making bolognese, but I was blowing you, because you said, you know, there's a cover charge.
I'm making blow me.
Blow me for everybody. I miss you. I wish the hell you were here.
I know. I haven't seen you in ages now. And the one time you're in New York, I'm across an ocean.
Well, I'm going to come back a lot. It's so cool, Adam, to be back and see the town waking up again.
Did Kelly come with you this trip?
Yeah. She's seeing some friends right now. And it's nice. I'm doing a little stand-up, and my daughter's got an engagement party. She's
getting married.
Yeah. Ooh. Aubrey.
Good one.
Aubrey. Yeah.
Wow.
I know. I go, oh, fuck, I'm going to die.
Wow.
How can I be that old? She's my oldest and my baby, you know? I mean, you think about it, it goes by in a second. It's just, which brings me to a lot of people are going to want to know. There's a lot of questions. What you talked about, it about taking off the dreads. Was that a major thing to do? Because in some ways that was your Amadeus look, you know? It had that.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't major taking them off, but they were a great thing for me. You know, it's like, I think a lot of people, when you're in the arts, when you want to do something like that, you just, there's all this stuff inside you want to express, and you don't know how to do it, especially when you're younger. You don't know how to do it. And, you know, with that comes other ways of feeling awkward in your own skin. I spent my life looking into mirrors and feeling like, wow, that's just not how I feel. That guy I see is not how I feel. But when I had dreads, that felt like me. It was the first time in my life I felt like that guy I'm seeing in the mirror, that's the guy I feel like. That feels right to me, you know? But, you know, I had him for 30 years too, almost. And at the end, I think I felt like, you know, I'm also okay changing this now. Like I'm ready to change it. I'm ready to like just stick my head under the sink sometimes and have it be not take 6 hours to dry, you know, like, and it's funny for, it was such, after I shaved my head, I was so, it felt so liberating that I did that all the time. I would like pass by bathrooms, not like everywhere on the street, but I'd be at a friend's house and I'd go to the bathroom and I'd wash my hands and then I'd stick my head under the sink, you know, and wash it and then just like dry it off and it's done. Is that easy?
Right.
I got really addicted to how great that felt just to like dunk my head in the water, you know. I would do it all the time. It was like a bad habit at one point. So I'd come out of a bathroom with a friend, you know, and Zoe would be like, did you just do the thing with your head again? I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I did.
Well, it's like obsessive baptizing.
Yeah. I mean, it just felt so good to just like, I don't know, pour water on my head. It just felt so good. I hadn't done it like that for so long.
Yeah.
You know, that I just, I mean, I'm a little better about it now. I don't do it all the time. I had my first haircut in 30 years the other day. I hadn't done a photo shoot in like 10 or 15 years. And Mark Seliger, we did a photo shoot like a month ago now, I guess. And so before the photo shoot, he found me somebody to cut my hair. I hadn't had a haircut other than like shaving around it. I hadn't had a haircut since, I don't know, early 90s sometime. It was weird. It was great.
It looks great. I mean, but it would look great if it was the other. It's just the pandemic did a lot. I think it really shifted it shifted people, a lot of people that don't see it in a positive way, because we had to refresh in order to stay positive and not feel like it's over, because it's not.
It was weird because, you know, people that we knew passed away like really early, right at the beginning, especially because that's when it caught a lot of people by surprise. You know, I had a couple friends pass away right at the beginning and I thought, oh, we're going to lose a significant chunk of our friends and family. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen that way for me. I mean, we lost 600,000 people so far at least, but at the beginning, it was so scary to realize, oh, this is completely different from anything we've gone through. This is not a bad flu. This is the Spanish flu from 100 years ago.
You know, right.
The really sad part is that so much of it got politicized because that caused so much unnecessary damage and unnecessary tragedy. But
And denial about it, because it's real. But the beauty is that science is working, and other people got it and got through it, you know, and lived through it that didn't want to once they had a vaccine. That's always the issue. I can't watch the news anymore. I'm exhausted, and I don't want to hear people argue. I want people to have any belief they want and not be angry. Just somehow have a discourse. I don't know how that can happen, but
just a lot of money in arguing. It's entertaining, I guess. And so there's so much money in yelling at people on TV that's what they do, you know.
Yeah.
The lucky thing for us too, me and you, is twofold. One, you know, we've been very lucky and successful in our careers, so a year off wasn't going to kill us, you know, like it did a lot of other people. We were very like, I don't know what the word is, blessed, I guess, whatever it is, you know. Like,
yeah, that's the word. I mean, you're on a farm in the UK right now.
But also that we found, especially both of us in recent years, found people to spend our lives with. So we didn't go through this alone either. That's the really big thing to me, that like, you know, I got Z, you got Kelly, and you know, this would have been a whole other thing in a different year, you
right.
know, where we were, back when we were single guys, that might have seemed fun. It wouldn't have been fun going through this, you know, to be alone and go through something like this. I had friends who went through this, you know, who were single, and it was
same
whole other thing, you know, when you're going through, especially artist friends, people who are emotional, not necessarily great at living with other people, but who really depend on contact with other people to like feel okay, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And is kind of brutal for some of those friends. You know, I felt so lucky to have Zoe gone through this. You know, that's like, wow.
Some people didn't survive in their relationships. And as people are coming out of it, they're going like, thank God I don't have to see you anymore. You're getting in an argument. I hope you get COVID, you know. Another part of survival during this whole pandemic was, did you watch more comedy? Did you binge, or did you watch comedian stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obsessed with comedians. I find it to be the most daring of all the performance art forms. My friends who do it, I'm blown away by the friends who are really good comedians. Not you, of course, but you know, like that. You know, but yeah, like the last few years, I've been really obsessed with like different ones. Mike Birbiglia's shows in the last couple of years.
Wonderful.
He's been doing these little things at Cherry Lane Theater, and the new one ended up on Broadway, which I was just. I think he's so brilliant, and they both move me, and they're hysterical. Jacqueline Novak had that one, Get on Your Knees. I saw it three times, bringing it back again this month. And I wish I'm gone for the absolute wrong period of time.
I want to see it also.
I want my friends to see that show. It's like, it's so brilliant. Her, like, her Iliad of blowjobs, you know, it's hysterical. And brilliant. I think she's great. You know, I could watch Jeff all day, every day, you know.
Jeff Ross. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
he's a sweetheart. We were able to go to the last shows. They're over now, Dave Chappelle's Summer Camp. And
I saw all the pictures.
Oh my God. Jeff was so funny. And with John Mayer and Dave Chappelle, who is deserved of the title.
I was so jealous of you guys getting to go to those things.
You would have loved it. Oh my God.
I've ever seen it. Looks so much fun. You know, and it's like when I went with Jeff on that, the USO tour years ago, was Robert Klein, Stewie Stone, me, Jeff, Sarah Tiana, and Colin Kane. And it was like summer camp. You got to go away for a week and travel to Germany with all these comics. It was so much fun. You get to be around people who are hysterical all day, and then I'll be tragic, you know?
Yeah, and you see Jeff Ross's habits of life, which is like, you know, he loves his pot, which is fun. He's always chill to be around. He's always making fun up with people kind of comments, and then he's always planning the next meal as soon as the last bite goes in his mouth. I'm hungry. You just had a steak.
When I was prepping to go on Joe Rogan a few weeks ago,
Which was great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I wanted to, like, you know, I knew him from news radio and some of his comedy, but I hadn't watched the podcast, and I wanted to, like, do some research and prep. But all I ended up doing was watching you guys, like the ones with you. I found out, I'm just going to watch Bob and Jeff. That's fucking.
So I have to go back to you. I have to ask these questions because I want to, and I want it to be proud. I can't do an episode, my 100th episode, because I'm 100 years old. That's how many years I've been doing this. I'm reading stuff I didn't know, that you had a band that you didn't even start until college writing music, right? You were a late bloomer.
Freshman year, fall term, I wrote my first song.
And what was that song?
It's called Good Morning, Little Sister. And it's actually pretty good. You know, I think I probably wrote a lot of stuff out. It's very simple. My sister was 16 at the time, or 15, you know, like 10th grade. I was gone. My mother was in Mexico at medical school, you know, and it's a weird time to be without your mom. You know, my dad's great, but like, she was a 15-year-old girl. It's a good time to have your mother around. And she missed me, I think, and she was having a hard time. And I wrote a song about that, kind of making fun of her. No, I wrote a song about her. And that was the first thing. I was in, I think, chemistry class. And I had this idea, and I started humming it to myself and writing the lyrics down. And after class, I kind of thought, well, I know how this goes. I wonder if I could figure out how to play it. And I went back to the dorm, and it took me all day. This is a song that would take me 15 minutes now. But at the time, I missed all my classes the rest of the day. But at the end of it, I'd written a song, and I played it back to myself. And it was like a bell going off in my head, or a light bulb. You know how when you're a kid, you feel so undefined. Mostly it's just people tell you where to go, what to do. You don't know what adulthood's going to be like, what you're going to be, like who you're going to be. Well, I wrote this song and I was a songwriter. I knew it right at that moment. That's what I am. I know what I am. I don't know how the fuck I'm going to do this. And this is not necessarily good news, but I'm a songwriter. And I just got to figure out what that means. You know, and so I did that. That's the rest of my life. From that
And day. You started writing song after song at that point?
Then I wrote every day. I actually, there was a piano in, there was a lounge across the hall from my room in my freshman dorm. And there was a piano in that lounge. And I could go in there and lock the door and just play. And I did it all the time. After that, I was there every day. I mean, because I started pouring out songs, most of which I'm sure are not very good. I have no idea. I don't have them anymore. But yeah, I was obsessed at that point. That's all I did.
And how did you join a band? And what was the band called?
Well, I started at Davis, UC Davis, and then I transferred down to Berkeley because I was a women's studies major at Davis, but I'd kind of gone through all the classes that there were there. And I realized I wanted to be a writer and the English department was better at Berkeley. And so I transferred down to Berkeley. And when I got there, I've been writing all these songs and there was not much to do with that at Davis, except like join a cover band and play frat parties. And that wasn't really what I wanted to do. So I got down to Berkeley and I met some guys through some friends from high school and started playing in one band called Model Society. And that lasted a couple years till about 89. And then I was tired of, you know, your first experience being in a band, you got to fight with people. And I got kind of turned off by it. So I kind of wanted to quit playing music. I quit the band and worked for a while, landscaping and construction work, and earned enough money to go like backpacking around Europe. And so I went to Europe. I was trying to kind of quit playing music and kind of get over it. And I was going to come back and get on with my life, but I really missed it. And while I was over there, Immer joined Camper Van Beethoven and they went on tour opening for 10,000 Maniacs. And I was just like, so fucking jealous. So I left Europe and I came back to the States. And like the night before I'd gone to Europe, I had gotten together with Dave Bryson, who we had a mutual friend and we had written a bunch of songs. And I wasn't sure what to do with that because I was leaving to go quit playing music, but I was thinking about that the whole time I was over there. And I came back and I called up Dave and we started playing in a band, which is the first version of Counting Crows. And that split up and I was in two other bands by then, Himalayans, which round here, Himalayan song.
So that round here came out of, so that was a couple of years before August and everything after then.
Yeah, this is probably around 1990, 91.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Himalayans. I was in my friend's band, Sordid Humor. Immer and I were both in that band. Immer was the bass player. I was singing the background vocals because they were so good. And so I was playing in both those bands and Dave Bryson and I were still doing, our band had broken up, but we were still playing acoustic shows every now and then. And then kind of what happened is, I mean, the Himalayans were getting pretty big in the Bay Area. We drew big, big crowds. And then Dave and I wanted to get together and record some other songs I'd written. So we got together with some guys that we knew from playing in other bands. Charlie, our piano player now.
Yeah.
And his old bass player, Matt, and our friend Steve Bowman, who was in another band that rehearsed in the same warehouse as we did. And we recorded four songs. And I really loved working with those guys. You know, I was in two other bands. And Counting Crows was kind of my like third place thing because we were just kind of playing acoustic open mics and stuff. But when we got together with those guys, it was pretty great. And I really loved it. And we put together this demo tape of Counting Crows stuff. Because in Himalayans, I only wrote lyrics. I didn't write a lot. I really liked it. I didn't have to be a band leader. After that first experience, I just wanted to play music and not worry about being in charge.
And you sang. I mean, you were the...
I sang and wrote lyrics.
Lead, yeah.
But... you know, I had started to write more songs again myself and I wanted a place to play them. And so that was Counting Crows. And we did some of that stuff. And we had this demo tape that had 14 or 15 songs on it, which is like, you're such a rube to do that. You know, you have one song on a demo tape, maybe two or three. You don't put out 15 songs because they suck and no one's going to like them. But I mean, this demo tape had Anna Begins, Rain King, Mr. Jones, Omaha, Round Here, and a bunch of Einstein on the Beach.
Holy shit. A bunch of other songs
the writer company wanted us to put on our first album that I didn't think were good enough. So, you know, it was kind of, we had gotten a lawyer and he was sending, and then we got managers and they were sending out these demo tapes. And at first they were like, we don't think you should send this out because it's dumb to have a demo tape with 15 songs on it. But then I think they kind of figured it was actually kind of a good trick, because just like the way they had reacted to it, they looked at the demo tape, thought it was ludicrous that anyone would send them a demo tape with 15 songs, and thought, what a bunch of idiots we must be. But then at some point they put it on and it's just song after song after song after song.
I mean, it's insane.
Yeah. And that is like, that's something that record companies, a sound may be attractive 1 year, but you never know where it's going to be a year from now. That might be dated a year from now, but songs, a band that can write songs can write songs. So that's something that like is gold mine. It's like, that's a golden goose, because it keeps producing those eggs, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they sent this demo tape out to a lot of people from record companies, I think. And because they finally decided that it was actually worth the bad reaction to get the one that followed. You know, that people would get this demo tape and they'd be like, who are these fucking idiots? And they put it on, though. If they put it on, well, I mean, it caused a huge bidding war. You know, a huge bidding war.
What company did you go with?
Geffen.
Right.
Because in the end, there were millions of dollars on the table, but Geffen actually, we got $15,000 between the five of us. So instead of millions of dollars, I took home $3,000 as an advance. Because Geffen gave us two things. They gave us a higher royalty, so we're investing in ourselves at that point, mm-hmm. you know, believing we'll have success, which a lot of people thought was stupid at the time. And they also gave us complete creative control, which means that no one was going to be coming around telling us how to make our records. And those two things seemed worth it to me. So we traded all the money in for, you know, creative control and a higher royalty, which we didn't know how that was going to work out. I was sure creative control was a good idea, but, you know, as it worked out really well. And when we did do very, very, very well, the higher royalty, you know, that paid off.
Well, that album, I mean, that's two Grammy nominations, and I think it should have won everything. Frankly,
let's sum them up correctly. We are a multi Grammy and Academy Award losing band.
That Shrek song, I'm telling you, and you loved that. You loved doing that too. You didn't even think about that. I didn't know that.
No, I was all for it because, I mean, that shit is timeless.
Yeah.
There are very few things that stand the test of time the way really good children's movies do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I've said this a million times, but you know, your mother probably saw Snow White. You saw Snow White. Your daughters saw Snow White.
So I got to ask you, the Crows, from the very beginning, it's all the same guys. It's Dan. I mean, it's everybody. Nobody. Well,
we've lost a couple drummers over the years.
It's not like Spinal Tap. They haven't exploded.
No, it was much, much messier than that.
Oh, it was?
Our first drummer left after the first. He was very unhappy in the band. And I think he regrets it now. But, you know, when you're younger and you just don't know what you want. And he's a great guy, right. Steve. And he's a very, very funny guy. But he was just so unhappy in the band. And so he was gone before the end of the first tours. Immer was kind of in the band at the very beginning. He plays on the very first album. He played on every album. But he had decided to join the band right after when we finished making the first album, because he played all over it. He decided to join the band. But then right before we left for tour, I think he just got kind of cold feet. He had been like, you know, he was a big fish in the indie pond. And I think he just got some nervousness about joining the band right then. He was producing a lot of records too. And so that's when Dan joined, because Immer at the last minute decided not to join. And we knew Dan because Dan had been, well, the band that Charlie was in before he joined our band, he was in with Dan. So when Immer decided not to join, Dan joined.
And Dan's hilarious. I have never, whenever I've been backstage, Dan is the most humble, most self-effacing, fun. He's such a good guy.
He really is. He's a fantastic guy. and he joined the band right at the beginning. And then Immer actually joined again. He played on our second album and didn't join the band. And finally played on our third album and became so indispensable that we had to let him back in the band at that point. So Immer came then, but he's played on every record. about a few years later, Matt left, our bass player, and Miller joined. And right around that same time, Jim, who played in a bunch of bands with Immer, joined as our drummer because Ben retired. Ben had been our drummer for 10 years, and he's just from Georgia. So even when we were home working on records, he was still far from home. And he and his wife, they wanted to have kids. So he's a teacher now in Athens, Georgia, and he's very happy. I mean, I miss him all the time because Ben was an amazing guy. But he's happy now too. We just added people.
Who's the amazing? Right, you add people depending on what you're doing, right? Depending on
we just keep adding guitar players, but I think we're done now.
who's the mandolin player that we hear on all?
Immer.
Right.
Immer plays electric guitar, acoustic guitar, mandolin, pedal steel. A lot of it on the new record is a lot of Immer. It's most of the guitars on the new record are Immer.
The new record is interesting to me because it brings back kind of the best of certain things, but it still has a whole different way of doing it. It's really, everybody needs to hear it. It's there's something real special about it. It's haunting.
I think it's a very unique piece of music.
It is. And I can't help, I have it written down because it doesn't matter what, well, it does matter what age. If people are younger and have not heard August and Everything After, and then of course what it happens is you get the gift of discovering an entire collection from an artist. Like I didn't get into Springsteen until around, I guess, Born to Run. And then I started to get into him. So then I went backwards and then I went, holy shit, what a gift that was.
That's the same as me. I got into Springsteen with Born to Run. And then I went back. My favorite album is actually the one before that, Wild, the Innocent, the E Street Shuffle.
Yeah.
The second side of that album is one of the places that I heard someone do music like Butter Miracle. And then it's three.
Yeah, there's a little Springsteen in the Butter Miracle and a couple other things that are it's music like you feel like you might have heard it before, but I want the second part of it, but be careful how you do those singles because they're gonna fuck you over.
I'm not gonna fuck that up again.
Yeah, no, but, you don't.
Bob, I was like, it was 2 minutes to midnight. I had just gotten done with the Rogan show earlier that day, so it was actually 2 minutes to 11 in Austin, and I knew that the record came out at midnight that night in New York, and so at 2 minutes to 11, I got on Twitter and I said, Butter Miracle comes out in 2 minutes. Go check it out. And I put a Spotify link. And then I clicked on my very own Spotify link and I went to Spotify to check it out myself and discovered 2 minutes later that it was all fucking wrong. I flipped out.
Yeah.
In 30 years in the record business, I've never accidentally released a record incorrectly. That has not happened before.
You release the singles separately after you've got your piece out.
I was just furious.
Don't even do the separate singles on the next one and don't give them any. It's like doing stand-up and never giving them any breaths. There's no air. You can't cut it separate bits.
You're not cutting a commercial on me. Forget it.
But I have to read these titles because they hit me so hard. Because again, when I met you, I was going through something so emotional and so deep, and August and Everything After, all I thought about was MTV, which was the place to be. And here you are, a young Adam on a train track, squatting down, singing around here, amazingly lip syncing to the track. It's insane how perfect that is. And you're acting. I mean, you're so connected to it. And that's how you are on stage anyway. I mean, your performance, you're not performing, you're zoned, correct? You're just there.
I'm zoned out on stage. It's funny, back then I was more comfortable in front of cameras than I am now. I think I look at myself in the videos for August and Everything After, you know, Round Here and Mr. Jones, and I'm so free, you know, I'm so completely comfortable. And I think I never really changed on stage. I think I've been comfortable on stage always, but in videos after that and on TV after that, I got a lot more self-conscious. I could see it every time we've been on TV since then. And in all the everything after that first year. Like, I'm great on Saturday Night Live and on Letterman that year. I just killed it. But after that, I think I got more self-conscious. You know, mm-hmm. you start to realize what it means that everybody's seeing you. Because I think at first I was like, I just didn't care. I just doing what I was doing, the way I am on stage. But I think now it's harder not to think about, you know, when you're on TV.
And I've gone through the same thing. When I had two, you know, family shows in the top 10, I was able to come out and be more ribald and irreverent on, you know, Letterman and all the shows. And then as more time passed, I went like, oh, what? This is interesting. I'm in the Ed Sullivan Theater with Dave. Why am I nervous? You know, it didn't make sense. It's, but that comes and goes. That's the phases of a artist also, and what you go through personally. But I, you mean the, I'm just gonna say the titles of these songs because they hit me. It's Round Here, it's Omaha, and these are from this, what I didn't know was your demo tape, Mr. Jones, Anna Begins. I mean, isn't Anna Begins Every Time She Sneezes, I Believe It's Love, I'm Not Ready for This Sort of Thing?
Yeah,
I mean, fuck, that's just, that makes me want to cry. That's your, is it a hopeless romantic? Is that what you are?
Hopeful.
Now you are. But were you always hopeful?
I think I was always hopeful. But I think my songs have a lot of sadness in them, but they have a lot of hope in them. I think that's one thing that sets them apart from just, they're not doomed.
But it's raining in Baltimore.
Well, it was, you know.
It was. And the Rain King, your themes, I don't know, man, they're every album you've done, it's so interesting because it's the way you speak, you know.
It's, you know, Raining in Baltimore, I actually wrote for Bonnie Raitt. I wasn't going to put that on the record. My friend Bonnie Simmons, who was a DJ in the Bay Area, she was very, very close friends with Bonnie Raitt since like the early 70s. And, you know, Bonnie didn't write a lot of her own material back then, and so her fans would send her demos and songs, and they would all get packed up in boxes and sent to Bonnie Simmons' house. And Bonnie would go through them and try and find great songs for her friend Bonnie Raitt. So when I was growing up, me and Bonnie Simmons used to go through these boxes together. Like, Bonnie found something to talk about, I think, in one of those boxes, you know? And so we would do this all the time. And like, Bonnie took me to a Bonnie Raitt concert, and Bonnie Raitt was so nice to me. I was a nobody. I don't even know if I had a record deal yet. I'm not even sure we were signed, but she was so great to me. So when we were making our first album, I wrote this song, Raining in Baltimore, and I was going to give it to Bonnie Raitt. And I wasn't going to put it on our record. The song, August and Everything After, which is the B-side of this, the vinyl for Butter Miracle, mm-hmm. was actually the song I was trying to record right then. But it was 10 minutes long, and it was really hard to play, and I wasn't a good enough piano player. And we were working on it one day, just like for hours, and I just could not get a version that went all the way through. And you couldn't edit piano back then because it was before Pro Tools. So at one point T-Bone got kind of frustrated. This is funny because this day River Phoenix and Samantha Mathis were actually visiting the studio. So it's T-Bone and our engineer and River and Samantha sitting in front of me while I'm playing this song over and over again and fucking it up. And then T-Bone's like, hey, let's just take a break. I need a break. I'm sick of this song. And he walks out of the room, and I said to Pat, our engineer, hey, just hang on 1 second, just press record. I got to demo this song I just wrote. I want to give it to Bonnie Raitt, you know? So he presses record, and I recorded it and got really lost while I was playing, and I finished it, and I looked up, and T-Bone's standing there. I could see him through the window. And he says, what the fuck was that? And I said, oh, it's Raining in Baltimore. I wrote this for Bonnie Raitt. I'm just going to send it to her. It's nothing for the record. He's like, fuck that. Fuck Bonnie Raitt. Fuck August and Everything After. That's going on the record. Play it again. So that's how it ended up on our record.
He's just brilliant, isn't he? Yeah.
It was a good call.
That's a damn good call. Okay. So I'm reading an article. And first thing, I mean, I'm on Instagram. I'm browsing through Instagram stories. And all of a sudden, you do like 10 panels about me. About what a good guy I am, and that you love me, and all this stuff. And I just start crying, and I show it to Kelly, and she goes, oh my God, that's the sweetest thing I ever saw. What did you just miss me, or what the hell?
Well, my PR people told me that the podcast was really successful and that they didn't understand why I hadn't been asked already and that I needed to do something. And I thought, I'll pander at a moment's notice. No, I know. I heard it was your birthday. I realized it was your birthday. And I just like, I wanted to tell everybody how much, I mean, yeah, if you know Bob Saget, you kind of love Bob Saget. You know what I mean? And you're the sort of fuck who this, you make this shit burst out of everyone. It's embarrassing, but you know, you get on the podcast.
You do. And it's the 100th episode. So you become the special guest and you look like you own a lot of land right now too. That's pretty. So this is the other one I'm looking at, and you're in Stereo Gum, which is a cool place to be. And it says, we got a file on you, Adam Duritz. And then it goes on and you like say this nice stuff, but you mention that I did this movie, Farce of the Penguins, which is actually coming back. It's a weird thing happening. I'm not supposed to talk about it, but I always do. But you'll be seeing it because they're making, somebody apparently is acquiring it and making a big deal out of the anniversary of it, a movie that was barely seen. But I put all my friends in it. Samuel Jackson narrated instead of Morgan Freeman. And it's just stock footage of penguins having sex. And you, I asked you to be in it. And we did, we had a creative consult. Do you want to tell everybody what your part entailed?
You wanted me to sing Long December and I wanted to say something about getting laid. And so instead I, my penguin is walking off alone into the distance and he starts singing Long December and he says, "Hey, doesn't anybody want to fuck the sensitive guy?" I think that's the line.
It, and your credit is Sensitive Penguin.
Yes. I am so glad that's coming back because honestly, proud of that.
It's a stoner movie. It's just like what it was. It had so many friends and comedians and it would say starring and then people had like literally two lines. But
that's like the kind of guest spot you want. I mean, for a comedy geek like me, that's like getting into the Aristocrats. You know what I mean? God, I was just thinking about the night we all went to see the Aristocrats when you had me and Greg and all those guys come to see it.
Was that for the Creative Coalition? I believe.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
that was. And you know, that's a movie that couldn't get made now. It just could not. But it was about, the idea was freedom of speech, but it was veiled in a joke about the most heinous thing that you could talk about. And George Carlin, who was kind of the Obi-Wan Kenobi, said, don't tell anybody, don't this joke, you know, don't tell it in public, you know. And then Paul Prevenza and Ben Gillette made a movie. But that was a special night, actually.
It really was. That's the night I became friends with Jeff, too.
Yeah.
We got to talking, and he was about to show at that comedy festival, he was going to show Patriot Act, that movie he took in Afghanistan.
Right.
In Iraq.
Right.
And so I came to see that a couple nights later, and we've been friends ever since. You know, I met him because I think you introduced me to him that night. And we've been friends ever since. And that must have been a really long time ago.
It's not recent. People, if they're watching YouTube right now, the video of this, you have a hat all of a sudden. So have you not been using lotion?
Well, I did, but I've been out in the sun all day doing. I mean, I started at 9 o'clock this morning and it's probably four now. So I've been here all day doing press by Zoom, mostly with South Africa today. And I just realized my head was getting like sunburned. I thought I put a hat on.
Well, you know, if this was the 30s, I would say, well, you know, you've always been hot headed. And then people call that a dad joke and then they get pissed at me. But my response these days is, well, you're not trying to think of a joke. You know, it's like, sorry, it sucked, you know. So I want to know, and because you've toured, I've gone to almost everything I've been able to be in town. I've gone to cities where you've been because to see you. I've watched you with all different bands. I've seen you with everybody from, the Wallflowers, because Jacob's been a friend of yours for a long time, and you sang harmony on some of his music, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you've been out with Maroon 5, I saw you with. How was that? Did you enjoy those shows?
Yeah, that was fun. You know, I knew them too because they opened for us when when we were co-headlining with Mayer, he brought them out. And they're just really nice guys. And they were good. They were good.
And Mayer, yeah. Mayer's a dear friend of mine. You must have gotten along great with him.
Yeah, no, he's great. He's really funny.
He's funny. He's like you. I mean, he's just, it's non sequiturs and name a subject or, and it's always a famous people roulette conversation.
Well, this is probably before he knew a lot of those people, because it was right like the first year his first album had come out. He was blowing up, but we probably weren't doing the famous people roulette yet, because he was pretty new to all of it then. He was great, though. He was great.
Now he has this new album, and the song that people haven't heard yet is, the single's really good. That's what's playing all over the place. But there's this other song on it, and it's one of those songs that just like, and my brain is farted, so I can't remember the title. It's the second song. Say what?
Swallowing Bob. I think it's called Swallowing Bob.
Yeah, everybody's writing a song called Bobbing on Bob. It's Bobbing on Bob, but it's a suite. So it's Bobbing on Bob, then Swallowing Bob, and then Throwing Up on Bob, and then Bob Don't Talk.
Sweet Bob.
Filing injunction against Bob, a restraining order against Bob. Anyway, so now the tour, what are you going to do? I mean, it has to be, I've looked, it looks like it's going to be everywhere, right?
It's mostly outdoors though. I managed to switch a lot of the gigs because I talked to a bunch of people in public health about this. And what they're telling me is that it is okay to tour indoors, but it's much, much safer outdoors. So we had 20, I want to say it was like 23 indoor gigs and 9 outdoor gigs. And now there's like 27 outdoor gigs and 4 indoor gigs or 5 indoor gigs. And I made sure the indoor gigs were just in cities I felt comfortable doing it in, you know, New York, New Jersey, where I feel people are very aware and very careful. I thought it was, I'm not really worried about the band, honestly. We're backstage and it's a distance, but I was concerned about encouraging the audience to do something that wasn't good. So, the indoor gigs are only in a few places that I feel okay about: DC, New York, Richmond, Virginia, New Orleans. The rest are outdoors.
Well, New Orleans, it's kind of like, I guess it's got its own Texas kind of thing. I think you'll have a maskless. I played Texas. I played Houston and San Antonio, and their attitude is, we're just going to shoot COVID.
Well, with New Orleans, I just, you know, we often, there's not the right size place there for us. It's either too big or too small. And I just wanted to tour there so badly. It used to be my home away from home, you know, and I haven't been there in a few years. So I just at one point said, we could change everything else. Don't touch New Orleans. I'm not pulling a gig out of New Orleans. We're going to New Orleans no matter what. So that one, you know, I just want to go there.
Yeah, you're part of it. I mean, your music even feels like it could have come from there.
I mean, all my housemates for years were, you know, Henry, Charlie Brown, Andre, those guys all moved out to my house from New Orleans. They were all my friends down in Crescent City who came out to Hollywood.
So are you going to do world stuff? Are you going to go out of the country?
I hope so. That's one where we're just waiting to hear. You know, none of those countries have really opened up yet.
Right.
Australia's kind of open, but not for people coming from overseas. You have to quarantine for 2 to 3 weeks, which is hard to do. It's too expensive. So we're just waiting. You know, South Africa, I think the UK is getting really close to where they're going to be fine. But the rest of Europe isn't yet. My hope is that in the spring, we can come over here. I want to go all the way around the world this year. I want to go to Australia, New Zealand, South Africa.
It's a great time to do it. It really is. And you'll have the second suite. That's why it's not happening so fast, because we want the second suite.
I think the second suite will put an end to COVID, probably.
I believe that.
Clear it up so we can tour.
I think you open with the second suite just to kill the COVID that could be in the house.
Yes.
And I also think that I wish people, you know, we're okay with, I wish the FDA would just approve the vaccines. So that's what's holding back some people. And some people are never going to take the damn thing anyway, which is unfortunate.
3 or 4 vaccines now, don't we? I mean,
I tried all of them. I get every 2 weeks, I get one.
you know, just to keep it fresh.
Yeah. I like the Johnson & Johnson because their baby powder put chrome on my balls and I had to have it scraped off at a car wash. Remember they pulled the baby powder?
Yes. I had a tour manager, Bob Weber, who, at one point, who was obsessed with gold. What is that stuff called? Gold. Oh, shit.
Where do you, you know
what I'm talking about? It's like a talcum that's got like a tingly. It's got menthol in it. Gold.
Oh, golden balls.
Gold
something gold.
Gold balls. Hang on, I'm gonna figure this
look
out.
Look it up. Look it up. It's important. It up. This goes on your crotch.
Yeah, it's Gold Bond. Gold Bond. He was obsessed with Gold Bond. He really loved Gold Bond. And then they
how
came
do you,
out
how do
with
you spell
that.
How do you spell that?
G-O-L-D. Space B-O-N-D
Gold Bond. It's almost like a James Bond product.
It's a very, it may have been what James Bond used to coat his balls to keep them safe from bullets and herpes, I guess.
Yeah. James, why are your balls so beautiful? Gold Bond.
He came out with extra strength Gold Bond, and Weber was so excited about it, he went and bought it. He put it on his balls, and we got in the van to drive to the next city, and he was talking, and all of a sudden he got quiet, and he goes, "Oh, it's a little too much. Oh, it's a little too tingly. Oh, fuck. Someone else has to drive. It's too much. Dude, I got to pull off. Hang on. Pull off on the side of the freeway," and like got a bottle of water, and he was soaking his balls on the side of the freeway.
You sure he didn't accidentally pick up a can of Old Bay seasoning?
Tony Chester's Creole seasoning. No, it was Gold Bond. It was just the extra strength. Just burned his balls.
The extra strength Gold Bond.
He was used to the regular Gold Bond. I mean, he's great. I'm still friends with him. He's does the guitars for Springsteen now. And he's a wonderful guy. But I hope he learned his lesson.
I remember the slogan now for Gold Bond. You know, I remember it. It was you know, don't shave your balls, burn them off.
It's like, yeah, Gold Bond, the Gold Bond Nair combo was always good.
I don't know if Nair exists anymore. It's kind of people just wax, I believe.
Yeah, I guess you would, but you wax your balls. You do wax your balls, of course.
No, I don't wax anything. No. I don't do much. Isn't that obvious?
I don't know. We're both so clean shaven these days. You figure we'd be waxing something.
Yeah, you look great.
You look great.
Oh, thanks. It's just this. I got a ring light. That's the answer to my life. See, this is worse. Look how much worse I look. There you go.
Yeah, it went downhill right then.
Yeah, it's phantom.
Look at the pores.
Well, Adam, I just want to say I love you very much.
You got to come back to New York and visit again.
I will. I'll be back soon. You know, coming back, I did live radio this morning. I went into Jim Kerr's radio station, and that's like the, you know, the music of then and music people listen to, you know, I don't know what it is. Top 40 for the past 30 years. And
stand up. Were you up at Caroline's or are you down in the cellar?
No, I went into Levity Live in Nyack. I need rooms to work out in. I didn't want to do the city proper because it's not right yet. And so I've been going in to some clubs. I'll be doing some theaters coming up in the next couple months, a bunch of them, of course, in Florida, and some casinos, but I can't go to Canada. I had a tour I was supposed to be doing, yeah. But I'm doing a lot of clubs because I've got to work on my new, it's all new. So I got to, and it feels wonderful. It's unbelievable to be talking differently, and it's just all different, you know?
That sounds like a lot of fun. If you're going to do another one in the city or right outside, you got to let me jump in the car with you or something. Just
done. Done. I need to see you. And we're going to have a really good time seeing each other. This has made me so happy. I'm so glad we connected. Thank you for staying on it.
Oh, no problem. I'm happy to. It was really fun. Like I said, you know, I put all that work in to get on here. Glad it paid off.
You put that Gold Bond on your balls this morning.
Cool as can be.
You're feeling the coolness on your balls?
Yeah, everything else is burning up, but my balls are cool.
Well, I want everybody, Adam, to get Butter Miracle Suite 1.
Nice.
Which is not in focus if they're looking at the YouTube. But it is, God. And they're going to go, well, wait, it's four songs. And but you know what I did? I kept it on it. So it did the singles. And I literally can't get the whole thing out of my head. It's that good. So congrats on such a great piece of work. And I know you're going to love playing it on tour.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, Adam Duritz, Counting Crows. Love him so much. You've got to listen. You don't have to, but I really recommend Butter Miracle Suite 1. It's listen to it all together. Don't listen to the separate tracks. And I hope right now, as you're listening to this, he's writing Butter Miracle Suite 2. And go see him on tour. I'd go to that New Orleans show. I'm sending you my best. Everybody, thanks. 100 episodes. Dang. I say dang a lot. And dag nabbit. So I'll be back next week with a new episode of Bob Saget's Here For You. You know what to do. You subscribe. You can listen. You can follow. Go to the YouTube page. You know what that is. That's youtube.com/Bob Saget. And you can subscribe to that. I never really pushed that because I never thought the, you know, the visuals on this don't always work. But I'm in a hotel room suite. So, oh, suite one. So I'm sending you my best. Lots of love, lots of health, everybody. And, you know, onward and upward. Thanks.